Hey guys, welcome back to our podcast. I'm really excited today because we have a very exciting guest. We've wanted to have her on here for a while. We have Laura from Save Our Scruff. She has a ton of knowledge. She's been in the industry for a long time. She's dealt with all sorts of dogs. A lot of you may know her. She's the founder. But without further ado, I'll just let her get started and introduce herself. So, hey. Laura, tell us about yourself.
Cool. Hey, yeah, my name is Laura. My pronouns are she, her. I'm the founder of Save Our Scruff. I've had a lot of experience with dogs, but I've also had a lot of experiences with human beings, which is the biggest part of rescue. I've been around in the rescue world for about 8.5 years and started Save Our Scruff about 7.5 years ago. And it kicked off and just turned into this beautiful, very busy, very powerful space of dog advocates and people wanting to make a difference in very different ways. And now we're just coming together and really like streamlining what is important to us and where our energy goes.
Amazing. Amazing. So what'd you do before rescue? Tell us a little about yourself.
Okay. I'm like, who am I? So I was an athlete my whole life. And then I went to college for volleyball. And when I retired from my sport, I was like, I actually was like, who am I? And things kind of spiraled a little bit out of control. I didn't realize that I didn't know a lot about myself and what to do with myself outside of my sport and all that it brought to me. But animals were a huge part of my life. So my sister and I grew up with every single animal other than a dog. We had rodents, we had cats, we had caterpillars and worms in the backyard, everything. And then we eventually did have one dog. But anyways, we were animal people. That was where my tenderness came from. That was where like I kind of opened up a little bit. And so when I was kind of going through this really dark time in my life, I was like, I need something to get me out of the house. And I didn't know what to do. I knew that the word breeder scared me because I just heard of like backyard breeding and the dog mill kind of thing. So I was like, I will rescue a dog from Kijiji. Thankfully on Kijiji, I found a fostering ad, which allowed me to step into the world of rescue. And I worked for a small dog rescue for about a year and a bit and very quickly learned what was needed in that space. I learned how many dogs were in the world and how that there were needs, like that human intervention was needed in order to make them feel safe or to get them physically safe. And I got pretty obsessed, awesome. Thankfully.
Well, that's great. So what made you do the rescue route? Because most people, when they get into the industry, it's funny. It's usually they work at a daycare or as a dog walker or maybe at a shelter. I know you mentioned you started with a small dog rescue, but then that would mean after that you went right to starting a rescue, right?
So, I mean, yeah, my kind of like involvement in rescue came on pretty quickly. As soon as I got into dog rescue, it became very much a big part of my life. And there wasn't the question of like, do I do rescue or do I not? It was just that now Laura is a part of rescue.
Laura is rescue.
Yeah, exactly. So the reason why I started Save Our Scruff was because I just didn't want to have to work within the rules and boundaries that I was doing so with the other smaller rescue, and they didn't run things the way that I felt was appropriate. I wanted to do things differently. I wanted to work with big dogs. I wanted to work internationally. I saw a need all over the place, and unfortunately, there was too many restrictions in that space.
Got it.
And I mean, when I started Save Our Scruff, it wasn't like I'm going to start this like huge rescue. I was just like, this is what I'm going to do on my downtime. I remember when I had adopted out 10 dogs and I was like, whoa, 10 dogs, you know, like that was a big moment for me. Little did I know that like 7 years later, we'd be at 2,300 at this point. So,
wow, that's amazing.
Yeah.
And when you guys started, what did the team look like? It was you, your sister?
No. So it was myself. And then I brought a few fosters and or volunteers from the rescue that I had been working with previously, because that rescue ended up kind of just folding, and the people that were interested in continuing working with me just came with me.
Awesome.
So I would say there was a few people with me, and then basically any of my friends that I could talk into fostering or transporting or like, you know, getting involved.
Got it.
It was very, very small. I did kind of everything, whether that was like picking up for the airport, fostering, bringing to the vet, adoption interviews, events, fundraising, like all that stuff. And not to compare it to like what we do now, we have over 100 volunteers working with us every single day that we would right now call our core members. Those protocols weren't what we were doing back then, but it was a lot of work.
Okay. Yeah. That's awesome. So how would you say when you started, what was your mission?
Oh, my mission when I started was save every dog. I thought it was absolutely possible to make every dog happy and comfortable without really actually understanding what that meant. You know, I was back in the day, I was humanizing these dogs. I was like, if I can get you a fancy bed and a jacket and you know, the right food and good treats, like your life is going to be happy. And not to say that can't be a part of what makes them comfortable and supported. But I wasn't seeing the full picture yet. So my mission was no dog will ever be euthanized. No dog will sit in a shelter. No dog will be neglected or on the street. And which has definitely shifted through my years of rescue.
Okay. Got it. So we can talk about how you think your mission's changed later. We can talk about what you think your new mission is, and I would love to hear that. Cool. But we'll ask a few more questions about rescue and what you guys are doing. So how big is your team now? How much of an effect are you guys making right now? Because you mentioned 2,300 rehomed dogs.
So we've rehomed 2,300 dogs. We've got a core team group of over 100 people that work for us almost every single day. So that's our foster team, our adoption team, our vetting team, our community, our fundraising, our events. And they're working not around the clock, but they're working every day.
Okay.
Almost. And then we have, you know, hundreds of volunteers working in the transport world and the foster world. So we've got probably under 1,000 volunteers at this point.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
Wow, that's amazing. What a feat. Congratulations.
It's really cool. It's okay. It's incredible. And I just honestly can't even visualize what that many people,
good
dog advocates, look like yeah. in a room.
Do you think you guys have made a change in the way people look at rescue?
I can say I definitely do.
Good. Yeah, I think you guys definitely have too, because the clients we've worked with, people we know that look at rescue, almost everyone knows Save Rescue Rough, which is great. But also a lot of people who've had bad experiences with rescues, they're really happy to work with you guys. And the people that want to rescue, you know, they'll have a bad experience and you think they're never going to rescue a dog again because their experience was so bad. But then they speak with you guys and I've noticed they have such a good experience, right?
Yeah, I mean, all rescues aren't made the same.
Yep.
And there's different things happening there. Like one thing is that Save Our Scruff has built ourselves up to a point where we have a lot of resources. We have a lot of human energy. We have a lot of people wanting to make change with us. So we can create protocols that keep people and dogs as safe as possible. Whereas smaller rescues don't have access to that. However, I do feel that our priorities and our values are very thoughtful. And we are actually considering the dog's needs over the human's needs, which I don't think a lot of other rescues have the capacity to do yet. I hope that they will learn that. And, you know, I didn't know that the first day I started in rescue. I didn't know that the first time I went to a pet store and handled a dog. So you have to learn through your experiences, and you have to be willing to be like, oh, I was doing this wrong. How do I do this better in the future?
Got it. You were mentioning something to me earlier about digestible dog rescue. Mm-hmm. Do you want to explain that quickly? That was off the record.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I mean, right now, our social media is really, we're trying to, you know, we want to flood you with cute dog photos. We want you to know what's happening in the world of adoption in our foster program. But we also want to make sure that you're staying in the loop about how rescue works, what it means to advocate for your dog, what it means to support dogs internationally, or, you know, even your friend's dogs or people that you see on the street. And dog rescue as a whole seems absolutely unattainable. It's like you could think of dog rescue as something that you can't be a part of. But if we can make dog rescue, if we can turn dog rescue into micro movements that are attainable for us all as common people, more change can happen. It doesn't need to just be three really powerful people doing all the work. If we can get 300 people doing small little bit itty bitty things, then you create much more change.
Amazing. Wow. Okay, good. So I want to ask, we have a whole list of questions and some of them are really interesting. So how do you feel about people's perspective on rescue currently, as an industry?
So this is a timely question, because my sister and I, whenever we say rescue right now, when we're on a call together, it's we almost cringe a little bit, because I think that word has been taken out of context. And, you know, our name, our business, or our organization's name is Save Our Scruff, Rehome, and Rescue. And so that word comes along with all these emotions and these stories and ideas of what it is. And I don't believe that that is productive. If you're only thinking emotionally, you're not usually making productive choices. If you're only like rescue right now isn't about, it's just how do we make things better and how do we educate people around those situations to like cause a ripple effect. I'm kind of off track a little bit, but
that's okay. Yeah. So you want to make, like, you want people to look more at rescue. Like, how do you want people to look at rescue?
Okay.
Based on their perspective right now.
I don't want people to hear like a Sarah McLachlan, you know, like song come on and just think about like, oh my God, like this is the worst thing I've ever seen. Yeah. I want people to hear the word rescue and be like, okay, what needs to be done?
Got
like,
it.
Like, I can do a job. I have human okay. energy. Maybe you can financially source something. Maybe yeah. you're resourceful. Maybe you're really good at research. Like, rescue doesn't have to be something that like is all consuming.
Okay.
It can just be an action point.
Yeah, and you know, I agree with you based on what you're saying, because people do have a very different perspective of rescue versus anything else in the dog industry, right? You can look at dog walkers, and people don't get hyper emotional about dog walking. People don't get hyper emotional about training. Actually, they do. but when it comes to rescue, it's like everyone's emotions come out. So whenever I get forms for training, it's always like along the lines of, you know, like, it doesn't make me that irritated because I know the training questions and I know how to answer them properly. But when I get forms for people wanting to adopt our dogs, I think that's when I get shocked at the things people tell me. They'll say, oh, hey, I know you mentioned all the dogs here have bit people, but I can give it all the love and all the cuddles and all the everything it needs. And I can give it the home it wants so it never feels the need to be aggressive again. When I see these things, that's when I really see a misconception, right? Training, yes, there are misconceptions like, oh, it's all on me, I messed up the dog. But when it comes to rescue, I find people look at it very differently than almost anything else in the industry, right?
Yeah, I think in the world of rescue, humans get involved because of the hero complex.
Yes.
You know, a lot of times, and I did this, I'm guilty of this, like I wanted to work with a dog, I wanted to have a pet because I needed help getting out of my own head, I needed help getting out of my own home. But if I had stayed in that place, then I wouldn't have ever been able to advocate for dogs. I would have never been able to change dogs' lives for the better.
Yes.
And so we have to, you have to put the ego aside and realize, like, there is more to dogs than you looking at them and deciding what you think they feel because of your own mood that day or because of yeah. what you're going through. And that's really tough for people to swallow because that means that they potentially were doing things wrong for a very long time. And if I couldn't say that, like, there are dogs that I handled incorrectly in my past, then I wouldn't be doing a good job moving forward.
Exactly. So. Okay. Do you deal with a lot of owner surrenders yourself?
Yeah, so at Save Our Scruff, I deal with intake, which means anyone looking to surrender a dog to Save Our Scruff comes through me. So I work with people who are, you know, getting a divorce or having a baby or have had a baby and the dog isn't adjusting well. People that have moved into apartments or have moved into new environments where their dog is just, like, you know, not handling it.
Okay.
And so, yeah, I work all over the map.
And what's your take on that? Because I think we have very similar opinions on this, I personally think now. I used to always think it was the owner's fault, always. Back when I first started, I'd say back in 2009, any dog could not do any wrong. I used to always think it was the owner's fault. So how do you deal with those now? Like, owner surrenders, if someone calls you and says, hey, a dog bit someone, how do you guys usually deal with that? Would you always take the dog?
There's a big gap in rescue. There's a big gap in the dog world where there are unmanageable dogs. There are dangerous dogs. There are dogs that need very specific living environments and situations in order to succeed that don't exist.
Okay.
And so what I love as a air quote rescue to be able to take on every single dog that needed to be air quote rescued. Yes. Does Save Our Scruff have the resources, have the adopters to eventually take on all these dogs? No, we don't. And so there absolutely is a, like, I would love if people that reached out to me surrender a dog would take more responsibility.
Okay.
But I don't believe it's not all their fault.
Yep.
At the end of the day, in the same way that we try to find a perfect dog for a perfect home, that means that there are dogs that are not in their perfect homes. And a lot of those
exactly.
dogs are the people that are reaching out to us saying, this is not a good fit.
Yep.
My question always back to them is, okay, given what you've gone through with this dog, potentially how many bites this dog has had.
Yes.
You are the one with the most, you have the emotional connection to this animal. If you aren't willing to put in the work, who do you think is going to be willing? And so I think that allows for some real talk.
Yeah.
because it's not fair for people to say this can't be my problem anymore, so now it's yours.
Yeah.
That's not what rescue in our name means. It doesn't mean let me just take that on for you. It means, okay, let's work together to figure out what the best solution is.
Wow, that's amazing. That's amazing. So we can talk about your mission a little bit. How would you say you've changed over the years in the industry?
Well, Save Our Scruff, Save Our Scruff, don't believe that every dog can be saved.
Okay.
I don't believe that every dog should be saved.
And that's different than what you used to believe.
For sure. Yep. And like, hey, what does saved mean?
Yeah.
I can go to Mexico. I can see a bunch of street dogs. Depending on my filter, that dog is either hungry, starving, like it's limping, so it's injured, whatever. Or I'm like, look at that free dog. Look at that dog that gets to do whatever they want. It gets to roam. They have choices to make. They have things to do because they're looking for food. They have a pack. They have, you know, that like, they have a safe space. So I think that's a tough thing for a lot of people, especially those that go on vacation when they are so used to seeing their pet dogs. And then all of a sudden see these dogs that don't have any of the things that they've given their dog, which is what they think makes them comfortable. But Save Our Scruff absolutely believes that there are such things as happy street dogs.
Yeah. I 100% agree.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I didn't believe that. Like, I was like, I'm going to save every single freaking dog out there. I'm going to bring them all to Toronto. We're going to find homes for them all. And then now I'm like, oh, wait, a lot of these street dogs don't actually want to live inside a home. They don't want to be a pet. They actually genetically cannot be companion animals.
Yeah.
And so that has made us have to pivot how we do things. And also changes how we partner with our international rescues, because we have to make sure that the dogs that are getting picked up off the street are the dogs that need to be saved. And the ones that are happy and like living freely get to continue doing so.
Wow. Amazing. Amazing. Okay, good. And what about overpopulation? So,
okay, good. I was like, wait, I have something else to say. So adoption is not a fix to the overpopulation problem. Adoption is not a fix to the unsupported dog problem. A big fix is spay and neuter. Is sterilization. And you know, these dogs are running rampant, just like breeding, overpopulating, having these litters on the street that are unsupported, getting hit by cars, starving, whatever. And it's horrible. So the only way to intercept that is spay and neuter, and so trap and release, basically.
Yep.
We are part, when it's not COVID, we're usually traveling 3 to 4 times a year doing spay and neuter clinics. We bring about 16 to 20 volunteers with us from Save Our Scruff, and then we have like 6 vets coming from GeoVets in the States. We do about 250 to 300 animals in a weekend.
Wow.
And then we get to wrap up, we call it quits. And we go about, we usually end up bringing back like 10 to 20 dogs from that spay and neuter clinic. But we also make, so this is, these spay and neuter clinics are the locals coming in with their dogs, and or we're going out and trapping mostly females.
Okay.
So that we can get them spayed, and so that they're just, there's no potential of them having litters.
Got it. So just so everyone else understands why it makes more sense to do spay and neuter as opposed to bring all these dogs to the city, it's the resources are very different to do that, right? Like to spay and neuter, if you were to spay and neuter 300 dogs in a weekend, with that same amount of energy, I imagine you can only bring into Toronto about 50 dogs, I'm guessing.
I mean, at the end of the day, every single rescue partner we have internationally, whether that be in like Egypt, Iran, Bahamas, Texas, wherever, they're at capacity.
Okay.
Which means there are too many dogs in a kennel. Dogs aren't getting what they need. And not because people don't care, because they don't have time, they don't have the money.
Yep.
And so there aren't a shortage of dogs that are ready to be adopted or ready to be shipped to Toronto to be eventually adopted. But we can't just keep turning that out.
Yeah.
We have to make a difference somewhere else in order for there to be less dogs that need to be in shelters. And spay and neuter is one of the, in my opinion, only ways to do so.
I agree. I 100% agree. I think I'd like to do one of those spay and neuter clinics. It's been a long time, but yeah. I'd like to do one of those.
Yeah, Save Our Scruff did a Spay It Forward campaign in February and raised like, I think it was like $16,000.
Wow.
To send to 4 of our rescue partners, so that while we can't travel to do the spay and neuter clinics, we were like, spay and neuter is still a huge part of our mission. we don't have to be the people that go down and do it all. How do we give money to the people that need it so that they can get it done in their areas? So.
Oh, amazing.
Yeah.
Amazing. Okay. So when it comes to rescue, how would you say you guys are different from a lot of rescues? I know you don't want to, no one wants to say anything bad about any rescues. No one wants to talk bad about each other, but, do you feel like there are struggles in support? Do you, cause you know, we've heard as trainers, I hear stories from probably 100 different rescues a week. And usually a lot of it is lack of support. So would you guys say that's a strong point for you guys?
Yeah. I mean, maybe I will frame this more as like, what am I proud of that
strengths?
We're doing?
Yeah.
And so our foster program is amazing. We have over 20 scruff counselors that are working around the clock that support every single dog in foster care. And those people that have signed up to foster had an interview. They had to watch a 2-hour video. They had a questionnaire.
Oh,
they had a case study questionnaire.
Wow.
So we could really understand how much they knew about dogs. And that way we could know how, we would know how to guide them to making better decisions. We also, every single dog that goes to an adoptive home is in a trial space. There's no just, oh, I like this dog, the meet and greet went well, and here you go. We now do 1 to 3, sometimes 4 or more weeks for, to decide whether or not that dog is a good fit, because it takes time.
So foster to adopt, always.
Always, yeah.
Okay, good. That's very smart.
Huge.
That's a very safe and smart way to do things.
Yeah. Okay. And we're just big on boundaries and structure. We're big on consistency so that when there is an issue, we can look back and say, okay, were you doing all the things that we asked for, you know, to set this dog up for success? If yes, then we can really fine tune what it is that's going wrong.
Amazing. Okay. That's awesome. Okay. So we'll talk about some more, just topics we both hear.
Okay.
So how has your perspective changed on euthanasia, which is it's a very hard topic for everyone to talk about.
Yeah. I took a big breath. let me just exhale. So euthanasia is an option.
Yeah.
Like, very simply, it's an option. People get emotional. I get emotional. Like, that's real life. But at the end of the day, there are dangerous dogs out there. There are dogs that are so unstable that they're like eating themselves alive. They're itching, they're scratching, they're so anxious, they're so uncomfortable, and they don't deserve to be living in that state. And unfortunately, we have to take responsibility in saying, I can't give this dog what it needs. Your life as a human, as a dog owner, will of course change when you become a dog owner. But if you are living a horrible life that is like wrapped around your dog's like needs, that you become resentful, you know? And so I think before even euthanasia is considered, people need to consider, like, are they happy with their dog? If they're not, guess what? You can actually change that, you know, with the right training, with the right management, with the right skills, with the right care. It is so much harder to live with a dog that you resent than putting in the work to train it and to really like modify how you interact and how you enjoy each other. Euthanasia only needs to be an option if your dog is, I don't want to talk in like statements,
yep,
but euthanasia can be an option with when your dog is dangerous to itself or others.
Yep.
And when it's unstable, when it's just, you know, living in the cage of its own brain, you know?
Yeah.
So I don't know how else to say that.
Oh, no, I agree with you. I mean, like, everyone has their own boundaries for euthanasia, and I think I might as well state mine. Mine is usually, I used to always think if a dog showed aggression towards handler, years ago, I used to think that it was, again, the owner's fault. And I also used to think the owner was just either being bullied by the dog and it was completely on the owner, or the owner was being a little bit too forward with the dog and stressing out the dog, which would cause the aggression. Over the years, I've met so many dogs that will just show aggression completely unprovoked against their own owners that they've known for nearly 5-6 years for almost near no reason. Or, you know, they'll even start it at 6 months. And that's where I draw the line. Because, like, if you're the dog's caregiver, if you're doing pretty much everything right, even if you had trainer help and the dog is showing you a level of aggression, and like we've had lots of dogs here that we've lived with as like surrenders with handler aggression, and every day anything can happen.
Yeah.
You know, like a dog can be safe for 4 months, and then one day you can just try to take the dog out for a walk and it just wants to bite you when you put the leash on him. And not like a little nip. Like, when I say bite, it's an attack.
Right.
And, or it could be the dog sitting on the couch and you get up to go to the washroom and the dog just gets really, really stressed out because you moved and the dog was sleeping and maybe the dog got a little possessive for no reason. Cause like you said, the dog it's in a cage of its own brain mm-hmm. and it decides to attack you because it had its own perceived thoughts about what you were about to do. I think that's where I draw the line. Yeah. When you wake up stressed out to take your dog out because you can't get a leash on your dog. For me, that's, I don't know if you have the same perspective on it, but that's hard. And then to want to surrender that dog and put it on someone else, that level of stress, I think is unfair.
Yeah. I mean, Saber Scruff, we haven't had to euthanize many dogs in 7 years due to behavioral issues. But all of those dogs got a very, very big fighting chance, you know?
Yeah.
And it really came down to like, is this dog adoptable? And what is the liability? Like, There's of course the obvious like physical harm that yep. that could come if the dog bites somebody, but also like you're potentially ruining that person's idea of what rescue is, and then you know that they're gonna go about and share that story because of course they're fearful, they're traumatized, and that is so valid.
Yep.
But then what you actually do is every single person that person speaks to is no longer a rescue advocate, is no longer even maybe
they'll never to be a dog owner. Rescue. Yeah.
So all of those potential homes that other dogs could have went into don't exist anymore.
Perfect. Oh, Cass just got here. Cass, join us.
Okay, so what I miss where we're at.
Okay, so we were just talking about, we were talking about euthanasia, and
okay.
Laura was mentioning how if certain dogs are really dangerous once they get adopted, people may be turned off from rescue forever. And she's right.
Yeah, yeah.
And she's right. Did you want to elaborate?
Yeah, I mean, that's really the like Coles notes of it, which yeah. and it's sometimes hard to say it so simply because it doesn't leave room for argument, but like it does the argument just draw things out, you know. Yeah. Does it keep that dog alive longer? Does it create really bad experiences for people while that dog is still around and mm-hmm. not supported? It also, like, dogs, especially if they're in board and train and then have nowhere to go afterwards, they cost rescues thousands of dollars.
Oh yeah.
So
yeah.
Like we spent like $15,000 to $20,000 on one or two or three dogs like wow. in the past, and although those dogs are very happy in homes now, what could we have done with $20,000?
A lot.
Right?
There was one time I did the math. I was like, if Laura has to send 10 dogs a month to a board and train because they're causing problems, I was like, holy crap. Like, that's a tough time. That's yeah. really a tough time.
Yeah.
And I was like, that's like unsustainable expenses, right? Because mm-hmm. the amount of dogs you can bring in is crazy with that amount of money. The amount of spay and neuters you can do is also crazy. So mm-hmm. yeah, I think you guys over time have probably developed an idea of when to draw the line.
No.
Okay. Good.
Yeah, we're working on it.
Okay.
But good. I will say too, like on the other side of that is you have a dangerous dog or a dog that you don't understand, you consider to be dangerous, you put them in a board and train, they go through the motions with the trainer, and then the trainer or you collab, you find a perfect home.
Yeah.
And then you work with that home and you educate them and they become real believers because they see the progress, they understand the companionship that they have with the animal, they see the perspective of like what it actually could look like to have a dog with specific management and structure and respect. And guess what? Those people also tell people, right? So like they can, the ripple effect on the positive way can absolutely happen. And that is what we're hoping more for, but sometimes, especially in board and trains with professionals, that's where we realize that dogs are dangerous and we just can't safely place them anywhere else.
Mm-hmm.
Got it. Okay. Do you have any questions to ask?
No.
Cool. Okay. So we'll have a story time. So when you started, were there any situations, which you'll probably remember because in your first year doing anything, you're pretty raw. Mm-hmm. And when something happens, it hurts. So did you have any bad experiences or bad stories from your first year doing this?
I think like the worst, like the biggest heartbreak for me in rescue in the first year or two was just realizing like becoming very, very passionate and then realizing how many people don't care.
Wow.
And having to just like be up in this space of like, holy shit, I can do all of these. I can do this. Like I have the power to be able to, I have the energy, I have the motivation to do all this. Oh wait, where's my team? You know, not to say I didn't have a team, especially when Saber Scruff was small, but it's like mm-hmm. the more you know, the more you separate yourself from others until you build them up with you. And so that was really, really hard for a really long time.
Sorry.
No.
We got just intruders all day.
Okay.
Sorry, we just have a lot of people knocking on the door. Okay, so Laura, you were saying about rescue and not having the same amount of emotion from other people?
Yeah, it's just like the more you know and the more driven you are, if you don't bring people up to speed with you, which takes energy and time and effort and, you know, which a lot of people in rescue don't have a lot of because they're busy spending it on the dogs, yep. You are very alone and you see the gaps very clearly. So I would say that was kind of my biggest bummer.
Okay.
Moment.
Got it. Do you have any specific situation? Like, have you ever had a situation where you were like, that was really difficult. I need a day or two to rest from that or recover from that.
Yes.
Okay.
My first and only, maybe not ever, but trip to Egypt. I was driving with the people that like sponsored me to come down there to work with them and visit all the shelters. And I brought a bunch of dogs back. I just saw like human experience of someone beating a dog.
Oh my goodness.
And I've seen those videos. Like my Facebook is just full of, you know, dogs in bad situations. And I didn't know how to be vulnerable enough to like say that I needed space, but I was just like, holy shit, this is exactly why I'm here. And I wasn't ready for it.
Wow.
I thought I, as on the rescuer side, could just be, know that those things were happening and be able to separate myself from that. But then seeing it so up close and personal, I was like, okay, like this is exactly what I'm here for. So that was really tough. And I probably went into like a little bit of a hole for a few days there, but okay. Yeah.
And what about the opposite? So have you ever had a dog where you thought, I don't know if we'll ever make anything work for this dog, or something just really difficult and you guys figured that out? Like just a really, really good moment where you're like, this is why I'm in this.
I feel like you're after a dog story.
Yeah, you don't have one? I don't think we have any stories.
So like, yeah, but you know what? Like one of the biggest, when you ask me, like, tell me something that like makes you happy or that makes like a life-changing experience in rescue. A few years ago, we were doing a spay and neuter clinic in Mexico and we get up real early. Like the day before we had prepped the whole space and we had no idea what we were walking into. We got there at like 6:30 in the morning and there was a lineup of like 100 people with their dogs at 7:30 a.m. ready to spay and neuter their animals.
Wow.
And that's just amazing. Being like, oh, like you care. Mm-hmm. And you care that we care and like we're gonna do this. Like that was huge. Like I was like, to this day, like I have a video of it and I just like it just restored my faith. You know,
good.
Like I'm here for a reason. We don't have to go out like searching for people that and tell them why they need to care. And people in other countries that we don't understand, like the culture and the environments that they're living in, we don't understand what it's like. So we can't tell them why they should care because we don't know what they're going through. We don't know what their priorities are.
Mm-hmm.
But when we're in other countries doing these spay neuter like initiatives, we want to make it worth it. We want to get as many animals in as we can. So sometimes we're having to go out there and like really talk people into like why it is we do what we do.
Wow. That's awesome. That's awesome. So in the rescue industry, because in the training industry, we have questions we hear all the time that annoy the crap out of us. Do you have a list of things you don't like hearing? Like,
such as, do you sell dogs?
Yeah, like what really gets you going? Because, you know, like for listeners, yeah, listeners like hearing all the positive stuff. But people like hearing, like, what do these guys hear?
Mm-hmm. French dog puppies? Do you have any French dog puppies? Wait.
French bulldogs?
Yeah. I don't even know the breed.
Let me know if you ever rescue a
puppy. I would like to adopt a French bulldog puppy. And then they'll give us the color that they want.
And then
like,
the color also.
Yeah. We get that.
Like a blue merle eyed.
I'm dead.
Yeah.
She'd just be like, they don't really have that in Mexico, but.
yeah. I'll see what I can get for you.
Maybe try France.
Maybe try France.
Try France.
What else? I think what's hard is just like hearing like, I've done everything. When people will reach out to you because they're at their breaking point, like, I've done everything. And then you're like, okay, but what have you done? And it's really nothing. And like, I can't understand their point. I can't understand like what it feels like to be where they are. Mm-hmm. But I'm just like, you haven't considered like learning to speak your dog's language. That to me is just basic shit. Sorry. Mm-hmm. But like, if you're going to adopt a child who speaks a different language than you, you're going to learn that child's language so that you can make them feel safe. You can make them feel secure. You don't adopt a dog and you're like, hey, dog, you're going to have to speak human, but I'm not going to even tell you how to do it. Doesn't make any sense.
Exactly.
So humans that don't take responsibility is really hard for me, especially when we've given them the tools to be able to do so. I'm amped up.
Nothing like these questions.
Yeah. And I mean, just questions that we've already explained over and over again. It's like we do so much to set people up for success. And a lot of people are really, really like eager to learn and want to be part of what we have, what we're offering. But a lot of people come in and they think that they know what they're doing. So they're half listening.
Got it.
And then they come back and they ask all these questions. You're like, we don't have the energy to do the work twice, you know, but we will. Because at the end of the day, if that dog's going to stay there, then we need to make sure that that is a proper placement.
Yeah.
But yeah, people are hard to work with. Like we're lazy. You know, like we'll try to find the easy way out of everything.
Okay.
And so, but that doesn't work for dogs, you know, and it doesn't work for humans either.
Has your communication style changed with these questions?
I and a lot of people on the team, I would say, are much more blunt.
Okay,
like
good.
We used to sugarcoat things because like we're human and we don't want to hurt people's feelings. But at the end of the day, like if you're not able to clearly say what you need from somebody, then you're only potentially going to get 50% of what you said back.
Exactly.
You know? So if you're like, here's my 100% of what I need, then you have the potential of maybe getting that 100% back.
Okay.
So being very clear, being very, very simple, analogies really work.
Yep.
I was working with a dog trainer, Jessica Kelly, last week, and she reminded me, like, analogies are a good one, because if you can get somebody to visualize what it is in a different scenario and then relate it to what you need from them in terms of dogs, they're like, it clicks a lot easier.
It does. Mm-hmm. It definitely does. A humanized analogy, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know. That's tough.
It is what works, though.
I know.
Even though we can't humanize them, but a humanized analogy always helps people. And on that topic, what helps, like, what would you say is the follow-through rate of your adopters? What is the most common fault they make when they adopt a dog? And do you notice, like, how have things changed for you guys to help them follow through more effectively these days? Like, do they get training quickly? It's a tough question because it's something we always try to figure out. I think it's the biggest problem in dog training, dog rescue, dog adopting. What can you possibly do to get someone to follow through better with everything you're telling them?
Check in more.
Check in, yeah.
Yeah, like finding ways to get people engaged on our Facebook groups or like in spaces where they're sharing with other owners and or other fosters and creating a community that way. Because people have a lot of experiences to talk about, but that you run into the issue of like people giving bad advice if they're not professionals. Mm-hmm. There's a fine line between giving too much information and scaring the shit out of somebody, not to make any mistakes, and then not telling them enough, and then letting them make those mistakes on their own, and then them feeling like defeated and they can't do it.
Yep.
So we're figuring that out. And really, there's no right answer. It's every single dog is different. Every single human is different. So you, like, that's why I think at the beginning of this, I said, like, I'm in this for the dogs, but the only way to work with dogs is to work with humans first.
Yep.
So we have to figure out how to communicate to each human and articulate things in the way that they can understand it and they can receive it the way that we want them to in order for it to work.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Got it. Wow. Okay. So yeah, that's great. For follow through, I think for us too, I'm always looking at how do we get people to follow through better. And thinking about it recently, I think you're right. You have to check in. And I'm always thinking about how can we force people to check in? Because every time we do sessions, I think the most annoying thing in the dog industry is if someone comes back for a second session after not doing anything from the first session. And we see that often. Absolutely. That's probably the most annoying thing we see.
My physiotherapist hates me for that. Oh. Totally.
And it's very similar if you have a personal trainer. Let's say you get training and then you go home and your diet is completely off, right? And then you go get training and your diet's completely off and then you have no result in a month. It's just not doing basic homework. So I personally think if a good check-in system is created, like, I don't know, for us it would probably be group sessions once a week. Mm-hmm. And if someone doesn't show up for group sessions, we're on them. Mm-hmm. I think that might be the best scenario for us. But do you guys have like a new way of dealing with that, or do you actually just call and check in?
I mean, it depends, because we're all volunteer based other than our three employees that kind of work separately from the like the counselor role.
Okay.
I often recommend keeping a journal for people so that they can see the tiny progress, because if you're like, especially when it has to do with something medical, like if you're looking at the same scab forever, you don't see it getting smaller, right? Yeah. But if you're paying attention to like how long it took your dog to follow a command or how long it took a dog to break a command, and you're writing it down every time, then you can actually see the work that you've done, and then you can it allows you to be accountable because you're like, okay, I want to write in my journal. And the only way that I can write my journal is if I do the work. And then they can show off that they've written in their journal by showing it to their counselor or maybe their trainer or something else.
Got it.
So journal is a big one.
Okay, good. Good. Another common question we get, and we're not a rescue, but if we get these questions, I can only imagine how many you get. The basic one, my dog bit someone, or like my friend's dog bit my kid or something. Dog bit someone and they want to send their dog to the shelter or the pound, and they look at it as one of the worst things they could possibly do. What's your perspective on that?
I don't think there's such a thing as the worst possible thing that you can do. I think it's a spectrum.
Okay.
And it depends on the dog. Some dogs, I mean, I don't want to think that any dog needs to be in a shelter scenario, but maybe that dog just needs to be away from humans and away from anything, like a variable that could be stressful, and the shelter system maybe will just give them some consistency.
Yep.
But at the end of the day, if there's no rescue organization to be able to take on a dog that has a like severe bite history, then where else are they going to go?
Yeah, so, the only option is euthanasia at that point.
Okay. And like, in my opinion, before euthanasia is considered, I do feel there needs to be someone taking responsibility of putting that dog into a board and train.
Yep.
Because like, their mismatched homes are a real thing. Yep. Sometimes you take a dog who has a severe bite history out of a scenario, and the dog is like, holy crap, my life is so much better out here. You know?
Yeah, agreed.
And they're a different dog.
Yeah, we have a dog like that right now.
Serious?
Yeah.
And it just, so I think before ever considering euthanasia, you have to consider going to a professional first. But
training.
Then it's like, who's gonna cover the funds?
Got
not
it.
Usually the owners.
And training-wise, so we can get into the nitty-gitty of training. What do you guys do at the rescue? Like, what do you guys teach? How have your methods changed? What'd you guys start with?
Okay.
Yep.
We started with nothing.
Okay.
It was, again, more like, how can we physically keep this dog comfortable and happy?
Okay.
Rather than, like, what is this dog saying to us? What does this dog need?
Okay.
Whereas now, we're very, very structure and boundaries and consistency focused.
Okay.
So any dog going into a foster home or a new adopter's home is like no couch, no bed, leash on for the first 2 to 4 weeks, no dog parks ever. ever. That's underlined it, yes, and bolded. They're always working for food, starting with hand feeding and then like just some basic obedience and stuff.
Okay.
So keeping things simple, it's hard work if it, you know, you haven't had a dog before and all of a sudden you're like life kind of revolves around when to give this dog what it needs and what it needs, but you're getting a dog.
Yep.
Like, you're getting a breathing being that's going to live in your home. Like, why wouldn't you want to put in the work?
Exactly.
You want to enjoy each other. So we also say no socializing for the first 2 weeks, especially if the dog is right out of country, because they're usually coming from a shelter environment and they just need some time to like not make bad decisions.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And medically too, we want to make sure that they're clear of any like parasites or anything.
Yeah.
That's very simple. So until after their vet check in 2 to 3 weeks.
Yeah, and on the topic of stress, I think that's such an important topic because if a dog comes in into a new environment, you may not actually see the full dog for even a few weeks, right? Due to stress. Stress masking all the behavior. And I think George is a good example for that. George is pretty aggressive. So when he came in, we didn't see any bad behavior for 2 days. And I was like, this guy's not so bad. But on day 3, it all started to come out. And it came out and it got worse and worse and worse and worse day by day. And we didn't put much stress on him. But he adjusted to the minimal amount of stress he couldn't handle. And then when we took him to Thunder Bay, and he was like back to the first day George we had, right? He was stressed out due to the new environment, and we didn't see aggression out of him. But on day 3 being there, he started being aggressive again. And then he's back here, and his aggression came back out. So he doesn't adjust well to stress. But when he adjusts, you see the full dog. So basically what I'm trying to say is for anyone who's adopting a dog, if you see a certain type of dog and you're like, oh, this works great, you don't know the full dog, right? Mm-hmm. Just the fact that the dog is seeing you, there's a lot of stress, right?
Yeah.
Especially if the dog is a little nervous. And then when you've taken the dog out of their country and put them into an entirely different country, they don't know it, but climate's different. They're adjusting to all the new scents. The entire place looks different. and then they go into a house after being into a shelter.
Yeah.
Or being on the street, whatever it is. That is an immense amount of stress. So you actually may not see any aggression or anything because of stress. But then when the dog starts getting comfortable possessing resources, now things really start to come out. So I think a lot of people forget that, which is why they put a leash on for a day. They don't see any bad behaviors. And then they go, oh, the dog doesn't need it. And
yeah.
I think that's what goes through everyone's head. Do you guys experience that often?
Yeah, I think the biggest issue that we see in that is that there's like that honeymoon stage, whether the dog's like shell-shocked and just like, hoping to fit in and do everything right. And then people are like, oh, I'm doing everything right, so let me change things. No. If everything's going right, keep everything the same.
Yeah.
You know? Until you've had 2 to 4 to 6, 8 weeks to really get to know if that staying, that like consistency and that like that good is real or not.
Yeah.
People, humans, we want a quick fix, right?
Yeah.
So like as soon as we are rewarded by things going well, we get lazy. And we decide to change, and it just it never goes well.
Okay, good. And what do you look for in a, let's say you bring in a nervous dog, or a dog that may need some extra work? What do you look for in an ideal adopter? Like, do you have a specific general outline? Not specific general, a blueprint.
Yeah, I mean, do we have a nervous dog? We need someone that's patient. We need somebody that is interested in learning about dogs and learning how to read them, because a nervous dog is going to hopefully give off like cues that they're uncomfortable or they need space. But we need people that are not only willing to read those, but also willing to respect those.
Yes.
Someone that doesn't want to just take their dog off leash and like, you know, somebody that has the right expectations of a street dog's dog.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Good. Good. Like, we have a street dog beside us, but I'd say, like, for people listening to this, if they're rescuing a dog and if they want that real reliability with their dog, I'd say Wolfie's very reliable. But in your perspective, it took a lot of work, right?
Oh, a lot of work.
Yeah, and I think that's what people forget, because if a trainer says it took a lot of work, it's going to take a lot of work. Right. It's really going to take a lot of work.
Yeah.
But she's super reliable. Do you ever not trust her?
I mean, when I just brought her out of the car, a bike just came out of nowhere at her, and that startled her quite a bit, and then she ran around the side of my car. But she came right back to the car, and she was still looking for me. So I think it took a while to build a relationship between the two of us, and that's what she kind of finds the comfort in when she is in an emergency situation, in her mind. But not really.
Okay.
But I think if I had, like, it's also because she's a very sweet dog and she's a very human-dependent dog. I think if she was more independent and had this fear, like, if she was, like, my beagle plus had her fear, I think she would be...
trouble.
I would not trust her very much.
No. Yeah, so I think a lot of people forget that, because they get a rescue dog and they assume that with a bit of training, this is going to be like the doodle sitting beside you.
Yeah, exactly. Right? Like, Wolfie is very, very reliable, but I think she's, like, at her ceiling.
Yeah, agreed.
And it's, her ceiling is way lower than my other two dogs.
Yeah, agreed.
I think, too, there's a huge difference between what people think training is and then behavioral modification. And you can cheat your dog out of sit and roll over, but, like, at the end of the day, that's just a party trick.
Yeah, you know?
Exactly.
And, like,
what
the most important question is for myself and for us at Save Rescue Off is your dog comfortable? You know, is your dog happy? Is this a good match? And by getting your dog to roll over and play dead, like, it doesn't mean it's a good match. That doesn't mean your dog is stable. So.
Exactly.
Exactly. And this, like, Wolfie that we're talking about, she knows next to no obedience. She
has
maybe 5 words.
She just knows lots of what not to do.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Lots of what not to do.
And if she respects you to listen to you, to keep her out of danger and keep her out of bad situations, then, like,
that's
a happy dog. And it's a happy owner.
Yeah, very much.
She's a lovely, lovely dog.
Yeah, she's a good girl.
Good. Have you seen any differences in dogs in different countries? Behavior-wise?
Yes. I guess it's, like, I don't think I've seen enough up close and personal. Like, we brought in dogs from all over the world. And I can generalize based on other people's experience, because I'm overseeing people experience dogs from, like, Dominican, Mexico, wherever. But I wouldn't say I have the educated eye yet to be able to look at a dog and be like, I know it right away, like, who you are and what you need. So,
okay,
I would take some time.
Okay, good. So some minor differences, but not enough to go like the dogs in these countries are vastly different, right?
No, not yet.
Okay, mm-hmm. Got it. And regarding training, so how would you say your training experience has been?
Experience, like...
like, what kind of training have you seen? Why'd you decide to go a certain route with the structure, boundaries, and all that stuff? Like, what made you decide to do that?
I mean, why wouldn't we want a dog like human to feel as settled as possible? And in order to be settled, you need to be consistent. And in order to be consistent, you need to be predictable. Like, these things just kind of all play off of each other. And so, if you are all of those things... you can then start to like fine tune very specific behaviors or things that you don't want.
Yeah.
And then you can add in new freedoms when like things are going well for 6 to 8 weeks, not 1 to 2 days.
And the main reason I'm actually asking is because I remember you guys put up a post. It may have been a couple years ago. Or maybe Jenna's the one who did it. But you guys put up a post, and then there were so many comments because you guys were mentioning the types of collars that you would recommend progressing to. I don't know if you remember that Instagram post.
Yeah, I definitely
post.
Remember that.
And there were like hundreds of comments on it. I didn't really care because I don't get involved. But so many, when people started sending me the post, I'm like, well, this is entertaining. So how did that go? And what made you guys want to post that? Do you guys remember?
Yeah, so we posted specifically to talk about, or just to open up people's minds about like specific training tools. Okay. We use martingales for every single dog that comes in.
Okay.
And then sometimes we have to move up to a prong collar. Sometimes we move up to an e-collar with a professional. And then that e-collar is being trained, or the next person taking on that dog is being trained by that professional.
And you guys doing that was groundbreaking in the industry, honestly, I think. At the beginning, true, when you guys did it, I was surprised any rescue would do it. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, are we a little bit nervous to write prong collar in a post at any point? Yes, mm-hmm. Because people are so quick to judge. But what people aren't, like, when people say the word prong collar, they're like, it's like cancel culture, right? It's like, absolutely not. Like, this is not okay. And it's like, have you asked what the dog needs? Have you asked if the dog is manageable? Have you asked if the dog is safe? And until you're getting the full picture, you can't decide what collar is right for that dog or what tool is right for that dog. I can't even say like a crate is right for every single dog, you know? It's so dog dependent. Mm-hmm. And so if you have such an a blanket idea for every single dog, then you're not doing things right. Like,
yep.
You're mm-hmm. just, you're, yeah, I don't know.
I agree. Yeah, because that post blew up. So, I mean, when I hear about things are getting crazy. Yeah, okay. So yeah, you guys decided to change things there. So training wise, you're doing in a shadow or apprentice, whatever we're going to call it. We'll come up with a name when we're done. But what are you exactly looking to get out of here?
I'm looking to polish some of the like messy skills that I have right now and really understand like what I do and don't know.
Cool.
I'm ready to like, I have a lot of experiences. I think in many situations I do know what I'm doing, but I'm ready to like put my ego aside and just be like, I want to be the best handler that I can be, because
awesome.
I have to support so many different types of dogs.
Yeah,
and like
awesome.
I, like we've said many times, like every single dog is different. So just because I can work very, very well with one dog doesn't mean I can work with the other 99 the same.
Yeah.
And the more I learn about how different dogs are and how like specific I need to be about fulfilling each dog because of their genetics or advocating them for them because of past experience or whatever. Like, I know nothing,
yep.
essentially. So, yeah, I'm just here to, like, get learned.
Good.
Yeah.
Good. It's going to be fun. We're super excited to have you. I'd say our last question, unless you have questions for us, would be, I asked you the mission question at the beginning. What would you say your new mission is if it's changed?
Our new mission at Save Our Scruff is to make people care about supporting dogs.
Got it.
Whether that's pets, whether that's international rescue, whether that's shelter dogs, whether that's spay and neuter, whether that's your friend's dog, your parent's dog, whoever. Like, we want people to feel like they can. We want people to feel powerful. And again, at the beginning, our mission was dogs, dogs, dogs. And now it's humans are the only way to affect dogs. So it's all about finding ways to educate people, finding ways to get into people's minds and say, hey, are you willing to consider a different way? And let's talk about it. Let's work through it. And let's see if we can come to a better place.
Mm-hmm.
I think
great.
That's awesome.
Do you have any questions for us?
No, I want to work some freaking dogs.
Okay. Okay, cool. Perfect. So thank you, Laura, for having us. I think next time we'd love to have you and Jenna on here. I think that'd be fun.
Yeah, she's cool.
Okay, cool. Yeah, well, next time we'll do that. So, I mean, I don't know about that.
That's okay. We can talk about it after.
Okay. Yeah, I think that'd be great to have because you guys both have so much knowledge in the industry.
Cool.
I imagine a lot of rescues probably reach out to you guys for support these days and help if they need some mentorship. So, yeah, you guys are very well known. It was amazing having you here. And, cool. You know, you're here for another couple of weeks. So if anyone has any questions, where can they find you?
SaveOurScruff.org, and definitely check out the Instagram. That's where we do most of our stuff right now.
Okay.
We're learning TikTok, but it's a slow moving journey. And Yeah, you can reach out to me specifically at laura@saveourscruff.org, but okay, only great. If you have a funny question to ask.
Oh,
something fun. Give me something fun to work with.
Something fun, okay. Yeah. Like my dog bit someone, but he also made me dinner.
Oh, my God.
Okay, what do I do? Cool. Okay, thanks, guys.
Cool.
Take care.
Bye.